This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 21st of September, 2006. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The immigration debate heats up again in Washington, D.C. as Boeing wins a major contract for border technology. A federal judge throws out Bush's roadless rules, effectively protecting about one-third of the National Forest land base. And remembering Orlando Letelier 30 years after his assassination in Washington, D.C. All that and more on today's newscast, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The UN assistance mission for Iraq has documented that more than 6,500 Iraqi civilians were violently killed during the months of July and August, with over 5,000 killed in Baghdad alone. The most recent report released by the Human Rights Office of the UN mission in Iraq lists gruesome cases of torture of Iraqi detainees. Signs of torture on detainees' bodies include broken bones, wounds to the head and genitals, and burns caused by cigarettes and electric shocks. Baghdad's Medico-Legal Institute reports having received bodies bearing signs of severe torture, including chemical burns, missing eyes, and wounds caused by electric drills and nails. Meanwhile, the U.S. House Judiciary Committee has approved the White House's guidelines on detainee treatment. The administration's language would alter the U.S. interpretation of the Geneva Conventions and make outlawed interrogation practices retroactively legal. Canadian Mahar Arar, who says he was tortured as a terrorist suspect after his 2002 deportation to Syria, wants an apology from the U.S. for its role in his case. FSRN's Allison Benjamin has more.
Mahar Arar wants the U.S. government to recognize the role it played in his 2002 deportation from New York to Syria, where he was tortured and jailed for a year under suspicion that he was an Al-Qaeda member. An inquiry released Monday cleared his name of any wrongdoing and chastised the Royal Canadian Mounted Police for providing intelligence to U.S. officials which falsely linked Arar to terrorists. Arar says that he and his family members are still on a U.S. border watch list. He wants to sue the U.S. government over his deportation. Meanwhile, the U.S. Justice Department is backing away from U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's statement that the Justice Department was not involved in Arar's deportation. A Justice Department spokesperson clarified Wednesday that while the Department of Homeland Security now handles deportations, in 2002 such matters fell under the jurisdiction of the Justice Department's Immigration and Naturalization Services. For FSRN in Vancouver, I'm Allison Benjamin.
Teachers and activists in Oaxaca, Mexico, today began to march on foot from the state's capital to Mexico City. Vladimir Flores reports from Oaxaca City.
Teachers and other members of the citizens' movement to oust the unpopular governor of Oaxaca will take 3 or more weeks to march on foot to Mexico City. The tactic comes 4 months after the start of a strike by public education workers. Negotiations between the Mexican Secretary of the Interior and a delegation of teachers and activists from Oaxaca were suspended yesterday afternoon with no commitment from the government to move on the main issue of the removal of Ulises Ruiz from office. This week, the Mexican Senate refused to take up the issue, even though the Constitution names the Senate as responsible for matters of removing or impeaching state governors. Persistent rumors are circulating in Oaxaca City that a police operation will soon attempt to clear the city center of protest encampments and barricades. The march that leaves Oaxaca City today will end at the doors of Mexico's Senate building, where march organizers plan to set up a protest encampment. Oaxaca City, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
Police in Argentina today violently evicted families taking over land for a housing project in Buenos Aires. Marie Tragona has more.
Local residents squatting several acres next to the Villa 20 shanty town in a southern Buenos Aires neighborhood were demanding the construction of public housing for families. They had been occupying the land for nearly a week. In this morning's operation, over 250 police used rubber bullets and tear gas and brought in a water cannon to evict the squatters. 12 people were arrested and several were injured in the eviction. Residents of Villa 20 say city officials failed to follow through with a housing project bill passed last year. The police were using the land as a deposit for abandoned cars. Residents say they will march to the city legislature to demand land and construction material for the hundreds of families in need of housing. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Immigration has once again become the topic of discussion in Washington, D.C. The Department of Homeland Security announced that Boeing won a major contract for border technology, and in Congress, both the House and the Senate are attempting to tighten control of the border. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
A minimum of a 3-year contract was awarded to the aeronautical manufacturer Boeing. They're to build a technological barrier on both the northern and southern borders of the United States. Jared Agin is a spokesperson with the Department of Homeland Security.
They will support us with the interdiction of illegal migrants as well as other potential threats operating or attempting to move across our borders.
The contract is for the technological aspect of the Secure Border Initiative. It's called SBINet. The competition to receive DHS contracts is fierce, as the government agency is new and receiving billions of dollars to implement projects. This contract is unprecedented. It has no maximum expenditure. DHS will provide Boeing with $67 million to conceptualize border technology. Then they'll receive the funds to implement them. Already a dozen subcontractors have been hired, and more are sought. And other contracts will be awarded for other parts of immigration enforcement in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, in Congress, lawmakers are creating guidelines for the Department of Homeland Security and its contractors to follow. Because immigration legalization is stuck in House-Senate negotiations, the Congress is taking up several of the enforcement provisions. Representative Phil Gingrey, Republican from Georgia.
Procrastinating or ignoring this problem will simply not make it go away. Every day we put off debating and passing immigration reform creates more and more opportunities for illegal immigrants to break our laws and violate our borders.
Democrats respond by saying this is nothing but election year politics. Democratic Representative James McGovern from Massachusetts.
The bills that will be considered if this rule is adopted is not about border security and immigration. That's not what we're doing here today. For those who are watching, this is not about the real legislative progress. No, Madam Speaker, this rule and these bills are about politics. It's about a press release and trying to convince the voters that we in this Congress are actually doing something when, in fact, we're doing nothing.
Despite claims of Republican politicking, many Democrats voted in favor of one of the measures. The House passed 328-95, the Community Protection Act. This provision would expand indefinite detention of undocumented immigrants. At airtime, the House had not yet voted on two other enforcement provisions. One would allow local law enforcement to report undocumented immigrants to the federal government. The other provision would outlaw the building of tunnels across the border. And over in the Senate, members are considering a provision that would construct a virtual barrier and 700 miles worth of physical barrier along the southern border. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
30 years ago today, on the 21st of September, 1976, Orlando Letelier, a former member of Chilean Socialist President Salvador Allende's government, was assassinated. Letelier and his colleague at the Institute for Policy Studies, Ronnie Carpen Moffitt, were car-bombed in the streets of Washington, D.C. by Chilean agents working under dictator General Augusto Pinochet. Letelier served under Allende until the 1973 U.S.-backed coup staged by Pinochet that resulted in the death of Allende and the ouster of his government. After the coup, Letelier was arrested and tortured. Upon his release in 1974, he and his family moved to Washington, D.C., where he was killed in what was the first international political assassination on U.S. soil. Christy Lipuma Herrera and Selena Musuta report on the 30th anniversary of Letelier and Carpen Moffitt's deaths.
Hector Alvarez, a medical student at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, stood quietly as a guitarist played a tribute at the site where a car bomb killed Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Carpen Moffitt. Alvarez found his way to the memorial service in Sheridan Circle, a 10-minute bike ride from the White House, to honor an important light from his country's past.
While it's true I'm not part of this history, and I come from a younger generation, I think it is always important to remember, to commemorate a historical event that marked our country and that was essentially a crime against human rights.
Letelier's assistant at the Institute for Policy Studies, 25-year-old Ronnie Carpin Moffitt, and her husband Michael were riding to work with Letelier on the day of the bombing. Only Michael survived. Moffitt's cousin spoke at the memorial service.
Seems like just yesterday my mom called with the news. She kept saying, sit down, sit down, as if sitting down would somehow soften the blow. We quickly mobilized to Passaic, New Jersey. Ronnie's parents, her brothers, aunts, uncles, and cousins. How ironic that it had been just 3 months since we had gathered for Ronnie's wedding. We consoled one another, and we accepted condolences from the many, many of Ronnie's friends and admirers.
At the time of their deaths, Letelier and Moffitt had been working to expose practices of Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet, including the creation of concentration camps, kidnappings, murders, and torture of thousands of Chileans who did not support his dictatorship. Because Letelier had worked at the Inter-American Development Bank, few Chileans had his level of influence, a threat that made him a strong target for the Pinochet regime, says his nephew Rodrigo Leiva.
He had many contacts in the international banking sector. So a lot of his work was making contacts with people in the United States, in Europe, to put pressure on banks and on politicians so that they would stop lending money, allowing Pinochet to be buying arms. And I think that's one of the reasons why also they did assassinate him.
Fabiola Letelier, Orlando Letelier's sister and a longtime human rights attorney, plans to testify as a plaintiff before the Chilean Court of Appeals on October 5th.
I am going to allegate before the Court of Appeal to obtain that the immunity of Pinochet must be removed.
Until now, the 90-year-old former dictator has yet to stand a complete trial for various charges pending against him. Because the United States government had such close ties to the Pinochet regime, Fabiola Letelier and others say the U.S. has documents tying Pinochet to illegal activities that could include the murder of her brother Orlando. Fabiola has spent years asking the White House, U.S. State Department, and the Department of Justice to release thousands of classified documents concerning Pinochet, including communications between the U.S. and Chilean governments.
Because of the tremendous crime committed here in the United States, there are a lot of documents that was transmitted from the United States government to Chile, to the embassy, from the different institutions of the country, and we needed that document.
Current Chilean President Michelle Bachelet will help inaugurate a new room dedicated to educating visitors about the life and work of Orlando Letelier at the headquarters of the United Nations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Christy Lipuma Herrera with Selena Masuda in Washington, D.C.
A federal judge in San Francisco threw out the Bush administration's rules for managing roadless national forest land yesterday and reinstated the long-contested Clinton-era roadless rule. The Clinton rule effectively bans logging, mining, and road building on 5.5 million acres of Forest Service land, about one-third of the national forest land base. Lira Bartas reports.
Federal Judge Elizabeth Laporte tossed out the Bush plan, which allowed the governors of 38 states with national forest inventoried roadless land to petition the federal government with their own management plans. In her ruling, Laporte wrote Bush's new procedures revoked far-reaching national protections of the prior rule and replaced them with, quote, a completely new state-by-state overlay upon forest plans that allow far more road construction and timber harvesting than the prior roadless rule.
This is a terrific ruling for all of the hunters and fishermen and recreationists and the people that really value these unique lands.
That's Todd True, staff attorney with Earth Justice, the group who represented about 20 environmental groups in suing against the Bush plan. The ruling puts President Bill Clinton's roadless rule back in force. Clinton signed the rule after 600 public meetings and more than a million public comments were gathered in 1999 and 2000. True says the ruling is a great victory for hunters, fishermen, and recreationists who supported the Forest Service's rationale for keeping its roadless areas wild.
What the Forest Service said, and it is that these places are unique, and we can't create any more of them. We're running out of them, and if we don't have a national standard to protect them, they're just going to get nickel and dime to death.
Governors' reactions to the Bush plan have been mixed. For example, the governors of Oregon and Washington say they intend to leave their state's roadless areas undeveloped. But former Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne was eager to move forward with a state management plan before he was appointed Interior Secretary. Idaho has the most inventoried roadless Forest Service land in the lower 48, 9.3 million acres. The state filed the first of two lawsuits against the Clinton rule in 2001, contending inadequate public input. Wednesday happened to be the day current Idaho Governor Jim Risch was scheduled to release the state roadless plan. Hearing of the court ruling, Risch released the plan anyway. Risch Press Secretary Jeff Storti says he expects more court action on the roadless rule.
The governor will certainly use any legal recourse that is available to him to appeal this most recent decision.
Storti says the governor prefers the Bush plan because it allowed roadless management for the state to be made with local input through 60 public meetings run by county commissioners. Gary McFarlane of the Idaho environmental group Friends of the Clearwater read Governor Risch's 68-page plan Wednesday and feels public input was not represented. He says the plan offers little protection for roadless areas in the four categories it outlines.
They are very deceptive. He calls one backcountry restoration, which is actually full-on-out development. There's one called general forest, which is unfettered development. There's one called primitive, which is motorized, and there's one called wildland recreation, which is semi-motorized.
Matthew Kaler of the Wild West Institute in Montana says while states and local governments should have a role deciding management of federal lands, Republicans have been trying to erode federal control and hand management over to the states.
That's very dangerous because if you look at states such as Montana and Idaho, Wyoming, Alaska, the resource extractive industries have an inordinate amount of influence over the local political process.
Idaho has an amicus status in the roadless lawsuit, so it is not expected to be in a position to appeal. But observers on both sides of the issue say an appeal is likely. Lee Robartis, Free Speech Radio News, Moscow, Idaho.
Australia's relationship with its close neighbor, Indonesia, both past and present, is being examined by two West Papuan independence activists who are currently in Australia. William Zongonau and Clemens Ronawery are both former West Papuan politicians who have been living in exile in neighboring Papua New Guinea since 1970. They're currently in Australia to protest against a planned security treaty with Indonesia, which they say will have a devastating impact on their homeland's ongoing independence movement. FSRN's Erica Vols has the story.
William Zongonau and Clemens Ranawery were both West Papuan politicians in the lead-up to the 1969 referendum, the so-called Act of Free Choice, which aimed to decide if the former Dutch colony would become independent or a province of Indonesia. Concerned with the handling of the referendum, they crossed into what was then Australian-controlled Papua New Guinea and tried to board a flight that would eventually take them to New York and the UN. But Australian officials prevented them from boarding that flight. Willem and Clemens explain.
We got a ticket. We were almost board the aeroplane. So the DC commissioner came with the police officer and stopped us not to go. They said we will arrest you if you resist to sit in the plane.
Because Australia stopped us, we believe that the picture would have slightly changed had we been given the opportunity to speak on the floor of the UN. Maybe no human rights abuses today, or maybe the scale would have been quite different.
US cables from that period estimate that at least 85% of the population supported independence. Yet, in the lead-up to the count, it became apparent that the Indonesians were in the process of fixing the vote. Just 1,022 West Papuans, handpicked and intimidated into supporting Indonesian rule, were allowed to vote. Despite concerns expressed about the handling of the vote, the UN accepted the outcome of the referendum, which legitimised the Indonesian takeover. Since this time, it's estimated that 100,000 West Papuans have died in the independence struggle. Today, while it's acknowledged that widespread human rights abuses are continuing in West Papua, verifying the scale of the problem is impossible due to a virtual ban on all journalists and UN personnel entering the province. However, the head of the Uniting Church Australia's International Mission in Asia, Reverend John Barr, has been able to travel there several times, most recently in April this year. He describes the aftermath of student demonstrations against the foreign-controlled Freeport mine that occurred just after he left the province.
The communications that I've had with my contacts there indicate that many students fled Jayapura after the demonstrations because there was a, what they call sweeping by the military and by the police looking for students. Many students were detained, and quite a number of them now have faced court cases and have received sentences for their involvement in the demonstration of between 5 and 15 years. There are still a couple of hundred students who have fled into the bush who are unaccounted for. And I think there is certainly some evidence to suggest many of them have experienced torture under the hands of the police and are very frightened to reappear again.
Clemens Runawari maintains some of the missing students were in fact murdered. Despite this, negotiations between Australia and Indonesia are continuing on a security pact that will include a clause requiring recognition of Indonesia's territorial control over West Papua. Reverend John Barr believes signing this clause would send a discouraging message to West Papuans that Australia is only concerned with backing Indonesia's wishes, and both Willem Zonganau and Clemens Runawari maintain such a clause would deal a devastating blow to independence activists still in the country.
Once that clause is built into it, the military there will have the upper hand to do what they want to do. A blank check, the legitimacy in parentheses, for them to do what they want to do.
Willem Zonganau maintains that instead of acknowledging Indonesian territorial control over Papua, Australia should allow independence activists a seat at a negotiation table to ensure the development of a real form of government that empowers West Papuans at a grassroots level.
Australia should lead and call West Papuan pro-independent movement on the table and talk to us.
They stole West Papua. They did not get it through proper means. UN must wake up. European Union must also wake up. Australia must also wake up to see these mistakes.
This is Erica Voles in Sydney reporting for FSRN.
Several key Senate Democrats signaled today that they will fully back operations in Afghanistan by the U.S. and its allies. Jan Meshe reports from the hearing room where NATO's top commander testified in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
General James Jones assures senators that the coalition forces in Afghanistan are making steady progress in rebuilding schools, roads, and providing health care to Afghans. But he warns that progress can be fragile.
But it's clear that the influence of narcotics on all organs of Afghan society, emerging Afghan society, is there. It fuels the insurgency, it contributes to the corruption, it is omnipresent.
Jones says to crack down on narcotics production and trafficking, Afghan judicial system has to play a critical role. However, he describes the Afghan court system as, quote, distrusted, overly corrupted, and resource-starved.
A top Afghan judge earns less than $100 a month. That's less than it costs to rent an apartment in Kabul, which now averages about $150 to $200 a month. Considerably less than Taliban are paying local youth to support their military operations, which is estimated $250 a month.
Democratic Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts agrees that Afghanistan deserves more resources. He believes, instead of Iraq, Afghanistan is the real center of the war on terror.
This administration has appropriated nearly four times more in reconstruction funds for Iraq than Afghanistan. And in fact, aid money was cut by 30% this year.
Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, also Democrat, says he supports the general's call for more troops in Afghanistan.
And I also just want to note for the record that no one that I know has called for a timetable to withdraw our troops from this place, as I have done with regard to Iraq. Right. Because I do believe this is a situation that can succeed, and we need to do what we can to make it succeed.
Right now, Iraq has nearly seven times more U.S. troops than Afghanistan. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
The end of royal autocracy in Nepal in April promised democracy, wedding hopes that people's fundamental human rights, including those of children, would be guaranteed.
But some say that progress on human rights is reversing, citing Maoist rebels as the worst violators of these rights. Maoists ordered hundreds of schools in Kathmandu and nearby towns to send their students to a three-day convention this week of the Maoist-led Nepal National Independent Students Union Revolutionary. Students' non-attendance could have meant dire consequences for the school's management. PC Dubey reports from Nepal, where the government has turned a blind eye to these activities.
Nepalese law says students may participate in extracurricular programs, but their participation must be totally voluntary and apolitical. The Maoist students' chapter sent notices to schools seeking them to ferry students in school buses to the Maoist students' convention venue in Kathmandu. One school official requesting anonymity says that if a school was reluctant to do so, it had to cough up hefty sums to enable the Maoists to bring students from remote rural areas. The amounts were often to the tune of US$1,500 per school. Ritu Rani is the mother of a primary school student. She says she and many other parents had approached the schools to complain about the notice, concerned that the children's participation in such political programs could adversely affect their psyches. But according to Rani, school authorities begged them to bear with the convention, otherwise their schools could face dire consequences.
The school officials were virtually trembling. They said any disregard of Maoist notice meant closing down the schools. They were already paying them monthly ransom.
Rani says Maoists had pledged not to involve students below 16 years of age, but most of the children at the convention were barely around 12 years old. Her child is 12 years old.
Their claim is a farce. I am shocked. They could be so inhuman. Forcing the kids walk several kilometers before reaching the venue. This has exposed their ugly face.
Raj Kashyap, an 11-year-old student of Standard 7, says that initially he and his fellow classmates were elated to go for the convention, wearing red bands around their foreheads and carrying red banners which their schools had provided. But they got tired walking for miles in the scorching sun.
We were thirsty. None offered us water. We were bored simply chanting slogans and listening to their speeches, which we did not understand at all. It was really a terrible experience.
Dev Gurung, a senior Maoist leader who inaugurated the convention, however, denies the use of any intimidation to bring out school children. He claims the students had come voluntarily as members of their Maoist students' organization.
Students participating in a student convention is a natural process.
Gurung denies that such political programs could be detrimental for growing kids. He rather says that this experience would cleanse their psyches of the feudal and imperialistic malady being nourished by the present mode of education in the country.
It is the responsibility of political parties to impart scientific consciousness to our students. Only then can we liberate our society from slavery, from agents of foreign powers.
Last weekend, the UN envoy and humanitarian coordinator Matthew Kahane in Nepal said that the strength of the democratically elected government was on the wane in rural parts of the country due to the increasing influence of the Maoist guerrillas. While just 2 days ago, industrialists and hoteliers in Nepal staged rallies in various parts of the country seeking security against reports of Maoist extortion of businesses. From Kathmandu, I am PC Dubey for FSRN.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can listen to this newscast in its entirety at fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.